This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Several top scientists in Pakistan, including the man known as the father of Pakistan's atomic bomb, are under investigation for sharing nuclear weapons technology and know-how with Iran and other countries. Pakistan's foreign minister said today, quote, "There are indications that certain individuals might have been motivated by personal ambition or greed." It was also reported that the number of people involved in the investigation could extend beyond the scientists to include what he called middlemen. While authorities in Islamabad deny any official involvement, skeptics point out that the scientists all work for Pakistan's army, have ties to the intelligence service, publicly support Islamic extremists, and denounce the West. And while evidence of the link to Iran emerged from a recent investigation by the IAEA, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, there are older allegations about Pakistan and North Korea and new ones about Pakistan and Libya. We'll follow the evidence and the links among those countries and explore the political problems this is causing in Islamabad and in Washington. If you have questions about Pakistan and proliferation, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now on the phone from Lahore, Pakistan, is Ahmed Rashid. He's a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review, the author of Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. And it's nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us a little bit about the man who's at the center of this, the father of Pakistan's atomic bomb, A.Q. Khan. Who is he?
Well, Dr. Khan is considered a hero in Pakistan. He was a metallurgist, actually, trained in Holland, working there in the 1970s, and then fled Holland with plans to set up gas centrifuges which enrich uranium. He took these plans to the then Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in 1974. This was just after India had first tested a nuclear device, and Pakistan had promised to match India. And he very quickly became head of the covert nuclear weapons program in Pakistan. So he's been at the helm of affairs for almost the last 30 years. He's extremely well known. And he has very strong links, obviously, with the military, the intelligence, and with Islamic fundamentalist groups.
And a national hero, is that safe to say?
Very much so. I mean, he's called the father of the bomb, the father of the Pakistani bomb, that is. And he's been long an advocate of the underdogs, that is, opposing the Western monopoly over nuclear weapons, and being quite an advocate for saying that smaller countries, especially Muslim countries, should also have nuclear technology.
Now, we should point out there are two basic ways to get material that's appropriate for use in nuclear weapons. One is, of course, as the byproduct of a nuclear power plant, and the other way is through the gas centrifuges that you talked about. What connection is A.Q. Khan alleged to have with Iran's nuclear program?
Well, the incident that has been mentioned by the Iranians to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna is that Pakistanis helped provide the same gas centrifuges that were first set up in Pakistan in the mid-70s, were then supplied to Iran in the late 80s, allowing Iran to kick off a program for the enrichment of uranium. This was all obviously a clandestine effort. Now, I think there are two issues here. The first, obviously, is that this was it seems to be a one-off thing. There does not seem to be accusations that Pakistan has consistently provided Iran over the last 16, 17 years with nuclear know-how. It seems to be a one-off thing that happened in the late 80s. But of course, the other part of this conundrum is that this is the first time in the history of nuclear nonproliferation where a recipient of covert technology has actually admitted as to who the supplier was. Now, this, of course, creates huge problems for Pakistan because it's not something that you can get off the hook very easily.
And as you've pointed out, this gentleman, it may have been a one-off. It may be, as the foreign minister suggested today, that he have he was motivated by perhaps ideology, perhaps by greed, but nevertheless, it's got to be asked, you know, the Pakistani army and the Pakistani government, you'd think they would have to know.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's no secret that the nuclear program since 1974 has been run by the Pakistani military. No civilian leader in Pakistan has ever had control of the bomb. That has been a very well-known fact. And clearly, the nuclear establishment in Pakistan is not only run by the military, but is monitored extremely closely by the military. And obviously, the question here being asked is that, you know, I mean, is it at all possible for scientists to go out on their own and start selling secrets without the military knowing?
And this may not have been the first time. What about North Korea?
Well, exactly. I mean, the same arguments hold for North Korea. There's supposed to have been a transfer of technology, nuclear technology from the Pakistani side, missile technology in exchange from the North Korean side. Now, the difference with North Korea is that, of course, both sides deny it hotly, the North Koreans and the Pakistanis. The problem with the Iranian side is that the Iranians are admitting to this, and the Pakistanis, therefore, are not in a position to deny it, and which is why this investigation has started.
And now the discovery that Libya had a gas centrifuge program for the enrichment, highly enriched uranium, and we don't know yet, but there's certainly indications that may have come from Pakistan as well, and the Libyans are apparently also willing to blow the whistle.
Well, you know, if that happens and if that evidence is proved that Pakistan was involved in the Libyan nuclear program as well, I think this would be an extremely a dangerous situation for President Musharraf, for Pakistan's credibility in the international community.
Now, Pakistan's nuclear weapons program was developed, obviously, in parallel with their regional rival, India, and that's the primary goal, to match the Indian nuclear weapons program.
Yes, Pakistan has always maintained that the only threat it faces comes from India, and that it developed its nuclear weapons and it tested its nuclear device in 1998 only after India had tested its own nuclear devices. So there is a very strong kind of nationalist, one-directional intention for Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. But we should remember, I mean, over the years, this program has been hugely expensive. We have no idea of the cost involved because these are secrets. In fact, the defense budget in Pakistan is still not a published affair. We only know the total that is spent on defense. We never have a breakdown of what actually goes to nuclear or to anyone else. So the issue here is that, you know, were scientists trying to pocket money for themselves by selling off some of these goods? Were they doing it in the so-called national interest in order to raise income for the country's nuclear program? Was the military involved? Many of these questions, I fear, will never really be properly answered.
There's another question, Ahmed Rashid, and that is that while Islamist solidarity may have been part of the motivation, at least as far as the scientists and perhaps the government and the army and the intelligence services may have been involved, that today's ally in the region may turn into a regional rival tomorrow when the government changes.
Well, I don't see the possibility of that happening, at least in the near future. But I think this whole issue can have very serious international and domestic consequences for the regime of President Musharraf. Already in the press here, he is being criticized strongly by Islamic fundamentalists for kowtowing to the Americans, reacting too swiftly to the demands of the Americans and the International Atomic Energy Agency. So he's already facing a backlash. And clearly, if more comes from the West, if more allegations are made, if the Iranians actually point the finger at individuals or name Pakistani companies or something like that. At the moment, we should remember that nothing is in the public domain. This is all part of leaks in the American media. The IAEA has not said anything actually publicly. But, you know, if you reach that stage, then things will certainly hot up.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Harpreet, who joins us from West Bloomfield in Michigan.
Hi, my question is that the U.S. government and President Bush has been insisting Pakistan has been a close ally of U.S. In terrorism, and they are our big supporters, and the U.S. government has been supporting them. Now, nothing in moves in Pakistan without the tacit support of the military. And how is the military, how is the government over there insisting that this has been done by individual and they're selling off secrets without the military knowing about that, about it? It is, I don't think anybody believes that, and especially the Indian government has been insisting that this has been happening, and now it's out in open.
Certainly the allegations may be coming from New Delhi as well, Ahmed Rashid, and you addressed the point about questions about the government's involvement in all of this, but in what ways has Pakistan been an ally to the United States in the war on terrorism, and particularly in supporting the U.S. Military and international military effort in Afghanistan?
Well, certainly Pakistan was the key to the military victory in Afghanistan in December 2001. American bases were here, aircraft and troops were based here, logistics for American and allied forces in Afghanistan went through Pakistan. And of course, you know, something like 500 members of Al-Qaeda have been captured by the Pakistani authorities and handed over to the Americans. So, I mean, and, you know, all the bases, the logistics, the whole Afghan operation is still very much run from Pakistan. So it remains very critical to the U.S. military. And I think the U.S. military is going to be very nervous about these kinds of charges and to the kinds of questions that may be raised in the U.S. Congress or in the U.S. media.
You know, the thing about Pakistan is that if Pakistan had not supported Taliban and Al-Qaeda, things would not have reached the situation that they reached with 9/11. And the other issue is, Pakistan keeps insisting that we develop the nuclear program with the Indians doing it, but the Indian government has never ever gone out and given the nuclear technology to these rogue nations, and Pakistan has done it with North Korea, with Iran, now with Libya. Pakistan is a rogue nation, and it is a country which has constantly supported terrorism. Anytime you see an act of terrorism anywhere in the world, it invariably has originated in Pakistan.
Harpreet, that may be a slight exaggeration there, don't you think?
Well, I certainly don't agree with the idea that Pakistan is a rogue nation. And I think we should remember Pakistan and India fought three wars. Now, as far as Pakistanis are concerned, two out of those three wars were instigated by India. Indians may have different opinions on that. So, I mean, in that sense, Pakistan's nuclear program, especially given that India exploded a device back in 1972, you know, has been very much geared towards a smaller country trying to defend itself against a much, much larger country.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid, a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review, the author of Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. He was with us from his home in Lahore, Pakistan. Of course, Pakistan developed nuclear weapons in response to India's nuclear weapons program, which was at least in part in response to China's nuclear weapons program, which, of course, was in response to the Soviet Union's nuclear weapons program, which, of course, was in part a response to the United States' nuclear weapons program. We're going to go back through the history of nuclear development and nuclear proliferation to see where all of the countries involved in nuclear weapons programs developed their nuclear technology, or in some cases, where they stole it. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Pakistan is questioning several scientists in connection with reports that they may have traded nuclear technology and know-how with Iran and other nations. We're talking about nuclear proliferation. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Joseph Cerincione, Senior Associate and Director of the Nonproliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. Good to have you back on the program, Joe.
A pleasure to be here, Neil.
We know where Britain and the United States first got their nuclear weapons technology, the Manhattan Project during World War II, a cooperative program. The next country to develop nuclear weapons was the Soviet Union.
Correct. And they got their technology by stealing it, basically, from the United States. And they developed their first nuclear weapon, tested it in 1949. They were followed shortly after that by the United Kingdom, and then actually tested it in 1950, just a bit later. And then there was a gap for a while until France detonated a nuclear weapon in 1960, and they had benefited from the U.S. Atoms for Peace program, which helped spread nuclear technology for civilian purposes throughout Europe, and the Euratom program that helped cultivate that. But their program is largely indigenous. China then came next in 1964, and they had gotten their technology from the Soviet Union. Israel was believed to have developed their first nuclear weapon in 1968, benefiting from a technology perhaps stolen, perhaps with some assistance from the United Kingdom and the United States and France. India detonated a peaceful nuclear device, as they called it, in 1974, which, as your first guest just alluded to, was the stimulus for Pakistan's program. Both India and Pakistan conducted secret nuclear programs, but they culminated in 1998 when both countries tested nuclear weapons.
And India's technology was from?
India's technology was largely indigenous, but they had assistance from the Soviet Union. That's one of the reasons it took them so long to get their nuclear device. They were very restricted in the kind of assistance they could get. But everyone has pretty much stolen, received, bought technology from previous nuclear powers.
And we heard how the scientist, Mr. Kahn, stole the design for a gas centrifuge from Holland, where he was, and also Pakistan is alleged to have had help from China.
Pakistan had a significant help from China. For example, they purchased just in the 1990s some what they call ring magnets. These are very powerful magnets that are used to drive the centrifuges that are used to enrich the uranium. So they had a lot of help with that. But they also put together a very complex supplier network. And this is what we're beginning to get at. That's what's so significant about the developments of the last few weeks. For the first time, we have a country that acquired this nuclear technology, spilling their guts about where they got this from. So detailing the middlemen, the supplier networks that go through Europe and Asia, and a lot of those networks were put together by A.Q. Khan in his effort to build the Pakistan bomb in the 1980s.
And, of course, Iran got in its initial start for a nuclear weapons program under the Shah of Iran, who got much of his equipment from the United States.
The United States sold the Shah of Iran their first nuclear reactor. There was some suspicion then, why would Iran need nuclear power if we're sitting on a pool of oil? But we allowed the nuclear reactor project to go forward. Interestingly enough, when the fundamentalists took over in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini shut down the project. He didn't want anything to do with this Western technology. But during the war with Iraq in the mid-1980s, the Iranians turned it back on.
And they're also getting cooperation now from Russia in terms of their nuclear power reactor in Bushehr that's at the head of the Gulf. And the Russians say they are protecting any nuclear weapons secrets from going to Iran. Of course, there are a lot of suspicions about that.
Well, the Russians are in a multi-billion-dollar deal to build at least one nuclear reactor at Bushehr. They've tried to put in safeguards so that while the Iranians might learn technology, they won't actually get any nuclear materials that could be useful for a nuclear weapon. But while our focus, the U.S. focus, has been for the last 15 years on shutting down Chinese and Russian help to Iran, we were ignoring Pakistan. And as it turns out, that's where they were getting the real the real goods, that is, the centrifuges that they need to make the uranium that makes the bomb.
Our next caller is Mary, and she's with us from Waltham, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to say that I think that our attitudes about this are a little disingenuous. I was at MIT in the 70s and 80s, and it was common knowledge that the Iranians were participating greatly in the nuclear engineering program there. We used to joke that they had bought it. Their contributions were so huge. And I'll just listen off the air.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Mary.
That's exactly right, and that's the heritage of the Atoms for Peace program. In the 1950s, when everyone thought that nuclear power was going to be the next great thing, that we would have electricity so cheap we wouldn't have to meter it, we'd have atomic-powered cars, atomic-powered airplanes. President Eisenhower decided that the way to do this was to have restrictions on the export of nuclear weapons technology, but promote nuclear technology for civilian purposes, particularly power and medical. So this nuclear technology was allowed, in fact, encouraged to spread throughout the world, and the United States, as the primary source of this science, became a great magnet for engineers and scientists all over the world. And just as you say, some of our great institutions were flooded with Iraqis, Iranians, Indians, Pakistanis. Many people learned their nuclear physics right here in the United States.
And the United States was not the only one. France, for example, I think when Jacques Chirac's first term as president of France, or as prime minister at the time, I think he sold the reactor to Saddam Hussein.
Sure, there is a lot of money to be made in selling nuclear reactors, both in selling the reactor itself and then the fuel. Reactors are very much like printers. Sometimes the reactor is cheap, but the fuel supply, the toner cartridge, that's where you make your real money. So you want to hook them early and have them dependent on you for their source of fuel.
Our next caller is Cash, who's with us from San Francisco.
Hi. I think it's a little disingenuous to single out Pakistan. After all, the U.S. has been doing it too, proliferating nuclear weapons to Israel, and that's the only country in the Middle East now that has the nuclear capability now. IAEA has been pushing Libya and Iran, but they're not pushing Israel to do the same.
They are pushing Israel.
The question is, why is that?
Well, Israel's not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferations Weapons Nuclear Non-Proliferations Treaty, as Pakistan and India are not signatory either, and North Korea just resigned from that treaty, so that would be not provide the IAEA any leverage. But they certainly, Mr. Al-Baradei, the head of the IAEA, has made recent statements about Israel. Joseph Cimicioni?
Yes, just last week, Al-Baradei called on Israel to give up their... Just last week, he called on Israel to give up their nuclear weapons. And in fact, with Libya's announcement, dramatic announcement over the weekend that it was abandoning its programs, this does bring a certain amount of attention and pressure on Israel. I don't think in the short term, that is the next few months, but over the next year or two, if in fact Iran and Libya walk back from their nuclear programs, there's going to be increased attention on Israel giving up its nuclear programs, and perhaps we might begin to see the U.S. get serious about our longstanding goal to have a Middle East free of all weapons of mass destruction.
Joining us now to talk with some of the intelligence aspects of this story is Robert Gallucci. He was an ambassador at large during the Clinton administration in the 1990s. He was responsible for nonproliferation and nuclear safety initiatives in the former Soviet Union. He oversaw the disarmament of Iraq. And Ambassador Gallucci, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
During your time in these positions, I should say you were also involved with North Korea as well. Was the United States concerned about a possible nuclear connection between Pakistan and Iran, or was, as we heard earlier, its focus on Pakistani cooperation with China and the Soviet Union, later Russia?
I think it depends on the time frame in which we're speaking. The focus in the mid-90s and through 97-98 was clearly on the Russian-Iranian connection, both in the area of ballistic missiles and in nuclear technology, and actually also in some areas of biological technology that might have applications to biological weapons. The Russians were building the Bashir reactor, a light water reactor. The United States opposed that, but in a sense came to accept that as a given because the Russians were so far along, and hoping through a dialogue with the Russians to convince them to provide no fuel cycle technology, the sensitive stuff that we now have found out was really coming, as Joe Cerenzoni has said, was really coming from Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the past several years, we found out, for example, that South Africa had a fully developed nuclear weapons program, indeed had nuclear weapons. It gave them up voluntarily, but this had been undetected by Western intelligence services. The United States was not aware that Pakistan was ready to explode its nuclear devices when it did, was caught by surprise by India as well. Apparently, these plants in Iran were developed almost to the point of being finished without anybody knowing they were there.
I want to slow you down just a bit here, because I think I'd like to take a descent to each one of those points, if I could, just briefly.
Okay.
The South African program was watched very closely and carefully, and we watched their brand of uranium enrichment technology develop a highly enriched uranium. We were quite aware of that. We were on to the site that they were going to use to test it in the Kalahari. There was really nothing that was much of a surprise about the South African nuclear weapons program, maybe the exact number of weapons, but nothing beyond that. I think when you, as you move along to the other cases, the Pakistani situation hardly took us by surprise. I first myself began working on that program in the 70s, not obviously very successfully, but we tracked that program all the way through. We were not aware, I think it's fair to say, of exactly the week or the day in which the Pakistanis were going to test a weapon, though since it came immediately after the Indian test, which was the real surprise, we were fairly convinced they were going to follow the Indians. But there was no doubt in our mind by the late 80s that the Pakistanis had nuclear weapons. They certainly were pursuing that program with great vigor, both through the two kinds of technology, enrichment and reprocessing. The Iranian case, I think it may have been a bit of a surprise in terms of the size of the centrifuge cascade, but we have also been watching and working to try to prevent that program. So I think you want to be a little more careful about exactly how much of a surprise you think all this really is.
Well, again, surprise to the public and surprise to those on the inside is also a little bit different. In the case of Libya now, we're told that the Libyan nuclear program was further along than people thought, but still some ways away.
From what I understand from the newspaper reports, it is further along than I think most people had thought, but still a program that was in development and not one in which facilities had produced a product, either a fissile material, either plutonium or highly enriched uranium. But I understand that it was further along than the community, the intelligence community, had estimated.
How concerned are you about this disclosure of Pakistani scientists apparently being involved, and are you suspicious that it may not have just been scientists, but indeed the Pakistani government?
That would be a very important difference. In other words, I think that for some time, people attentive to this have worried that individual Pakistani scientists might have been traveling about and sharing technology, whether it be with Iran or with North Korea or elsewhere in the Middle East. And I don't think that is so much of a surprise. There's great concern that they might even share this technology with Al-Qaeda. It would be another matter, again, if this were happening with the approval or without the opposition of the Pakistani government. I think we have taken it somewhat at face value, Musharraf's assurances that he would put an end to this ever since the issue of the Pakistani assistance to North Korea became such an issue in our policy towards Pyongyang.
We're speaking with Robert Gallucci and with Joseph Cerenzoni about news from Pakistan that scientists may have been involved in sharing nuclear technology and know-how with other nations. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Gary, who joins us from Lexington, Missouri.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. It seems as though Musharraf's relationship with his people is tenuous at best. If we should take on the Pakistanis for proliferating nuclear weapons and thus perhaps further alienate him from his people, wouldn't we then run the risk of radicalizing Pakistan and make our task of possibly gaining the upper hand on Al-Qaeda and those elements that still remain in western Pakistan and eastern Afghanistan that much more difficult.
A real poser. Robert Gallucci, do you want to take a shot at that?
I'll take the first shot. I think when we think about the various kinds of ways in which Pakistan can threaten our interests or is important to solving some problems, I think we should start with the one threat that we really must deal with most effectively, and that is that a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda would get either a fabricated nuclear weapon or fissile material which they could make into a nuclear weapon. And I do not mean a radiological device, I mean a nuclear weapon. And if there is any Pakistani assistance, whether from the government authorized or unopposed, or from Pakistani nationals, that's the principal threat. Pakistan is, in a way, uniquely capable uniquely likely to be a source of such assistance, given its the elements that are radically Islamic in the country, and given its scientific capacity, both in the technology and in actual weapons capability. So that has to be the focus. Now, the question, of course, the caller raises is pressure on the government likely to produce the restraint we want, or is it likely to be provocative and produce exactly the opposite outcome? I mean, that's why I think we pay the people we do to be diplomats and to figure out when to apply pressure, when to use the carrot, and when to use the stick. I believe the administration has been betting on Musharraf as an actor who would intervene to prevent this kind of a transfer. If that turns out not to have been a good bet, it will have been a big mistake.
Joseph Cerenzioni, you'll take a shot at that, I hope?
Yes, absolutely. The administration, for the last couple of years, has publicized the theory that the greatest danger to the United States comes from the nexus of terrorists, weapons of mass destruction, and rogue states. And this has been now widely accepted, and I agree with Bob that it's true our greatest threat comes from the possibility that some terrorist group could acquire a nuclear weapon and use it against us. But that third part of the equation, it turns out, is wrong. It's not rogue states. It's really any state's arsenal. And by focusing too much on the rogue states over the last few years, we actually have missed the bigger picture. And the news about Pakistan over the last couple of weeks really should open our eyes to the fact that we have to take much greater care to secure all states' arsenals, in particular those that don't have very strong state controls on them. Russia, of course, and now Pakistan, because Bob is right. If something goes wrong with that government, we could have a nuclear nightmare that none of us want to live in.
Joseph Cerenzione of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thank you very much. Robert Gallucci is now the Dean of Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. We thank you for your time today as well. After the break, call it standing online or standing in line. Either way, we're all doing it at this time of the year. What's your horror story of waiting and waiting and waiting this holiday season? 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.